Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Thursday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. This is Wednesday morning, and you'll be hearing the show at noon on Thursday or everywhere else on the Pacifica Network. We, of course, begin our show every day with the powerful testimony of Lieutenant Colonel Vindman during the impeachment hearings of 2019. It is a testament to immigration. It is a testament to patriotism. It's a testament to talking truth to power. The consequences, personally, for Colonel Vindman were not good. He was walked out of the White House, and then he eventually walked away from his service for the country because of the harassment he was getting. But you need to hear his words as you exercise the franchise in November of 2020. Now, Lieutenant Colonel Vindman.
Next month will mark 40 years since my family arrived in the United States as refugees. When my father was 47 years old, he left behind his entire life and the only home he had ever known to start over in the United States so his three sons could have a better and safer lives. His courageous decision inspired a deep sense of gratitude in my brothers and myself and instilled in us a sense of duty and service. All three of us have served or are currently serving in the military. My little brother sits behind me here today. Our collective military service is a special part of our family's history, a story in America. I'm grateful for my father's brave act of hope 40 years ago and for the privilege of being an American citizen and public servant, where I can live free and free of fear for mine and my family's safety. Dad, I'm sitting here today in the U.S. Capitol talking to our elected professionals. Talking to our elected professionals is proof that you made the right decision 40 years ago to leave the Soviet Union and come here to the United States of America in search of a better life for our family. Do not worry. I will be fine for telling the truth. Thank you again for your consideration. I'll be happy to answer your questions.
For our first guest, I'm going to double dip with Hedrick Smith. He has spent a tremendous amount of time looking at how we kind of can renew our democratic institutions. He's looking at the vote. He's looking at gerrymandering. He's looking at just, I mean, everything that sort of is important if you're going to have a thriving democracy in America. I called him up because he has an organization called ReclaimTheAmericanDream.org, ReclaimTheAmericanDream.org. And I said, I want you to talk about what you were writing about and what you were seeing in the country. But Hedrick, you have been around the block a lot. And as a result, we cannot avoid talking about this interesting Democratic convention that we have been seeing rolling out starting Monday night. And I just want everyone to know why you are so important. You're a Pulitzer Prize winning former New York Times reporter, an Emmy Award winning documentary producer for PBS and PBS Frontline. And for five decades, not only have you been a reporter, an editor, a producer, but a prolific author. So I just want people to understand that when I say, Hedrick, we got to talk about this convention. You have this arc of history. And this.
I've been at a few conventions.
Yeah, I'm sure you have. So tell me a little bit about what you've seen over the last couple of nights. Obviously, we've talked about what happened on Monday night and Tuesday night. What were your thoughts about last night? Last night was very interesting because it was kind of an introduction not only to Mrs. Biden, but sort of an introduction to who we are as America with all the different states,
doing it. Both nights, Arnie, I have been impressed, delighted, and intrigued by the use of ordinary Americans. That we are the people is the theme. And the people are much more interesting than the politicians. I mean, it started that first night with that very moving business of young kids from all over the country singing the national anthem and singing other songs. I mean, it brought tears to people's eyes. We had people calling us up and sharing their reactions with literally within the first 3 or 4 minutes. So yeah. It was really unusual. But beyond that, they've gone on and they've had the testimonials of people, Marine captain who says, I can't serve the country anymore with the situation we're in. A police commissioner or the head of police in Houston, Texas. Yeah, a young woman saying, my father died. And the only reason he died is he went out and he trusted Donald Trump. I mean, these personal testimonials and just simply seeing the country. Last night when they were going, two nights ago when they were going.
The quilt of America, the quilt.
When they were showing the casting of the ballots, the roll call, everybody said, how are they going to have a dramatic roll call? Well, I've been there for those roll calls. And I've watched those demonstrations and waves of people and swaying around and the marching and the cheering and the bands playing and enormous noise. And there was a question in everybody's mind who's had that experience. What's it going to be like when it's being done remote? Well, it was done beautifully. I mean, you saw somebody out in Wyoming standing in front of a bunch of black Angus cattle. You saw somebody in Hawaii standing with the lagoons in the background and the mountains. And then, you know, down in Alabama, it was something else. And then New York, it was something. I mean, it was.
And wonderful. The calamari in Rhode Island. I loved it. Oh, look at he's got squid on his plate.
Now I'm famous for the calamari because of that remark. I think the tapestry of America was fascinating to see. And it was not just entertainment, but it was a reminder of how diverse and how sprawling and how enormous this country is and how difficult it is to pull it together. But how much kind of buoyancy, energy, strength, optimism, idealism, hope, and courage there is out there in the country. People are eager in this party, eager for change, eager for a new break, determined to get rid of a president that they don't approve of. But they also had an exuberance that was America. You know, I mean, Ronald Reagan was famous for that theme, morning again in America. And one of the things that political strategists say, sell hope. Sell optimism, sell confidence in America's future. Americans are inherently an optimistic people, and pessimism doesn't sell. Well, it sold in 2016 when Donald Trump was running. It didn't sell to the majority in terms of the popular vote, but it sold in enough states to win the electoral vote. Normally speaking, politics is better when it's upbeat. And so, I would say the upbeat sense of it was really important.
And then, it was,
I mean, if you come to Jill Biden, you got the same thing. Jill Biden in a green dress is an upbeat teacher who
in an empty classroom.
She believes in the next generation. She believes in investing her energy and her talent and her caring in the next generation of kids. So you got the same kind of feeling from her. And then he walks in the room, puts his arm around her and smiles and says, sort of almost bashfully, thanks for listening. You know, I mean, it's a very human experience. I don't think we've been experiencing politics that way for a very long time. Somebody said afterwards, one of the commentators afterwards said, you know, we probably never do the roll call vote again the same way we've done it before. This may have changed it forever because it was so appealing. There may be something to that. There's a way of drawing the country in and making a political convention more of a connection with the country than a showcase for a bunch of either established or former or up and coming politicians. And I think that really worked. I was amazed. I think they've done a marvelous job. And to think that they never had a technical snafu. I mean, they were running those things snap, snap, snap. They went from one to another.
And you know this better than anyone, having done this kind of work.
My hat off to them. I know what that's like. It's terrible. And we had a little trouble hooking up this morning ourselves. It's just two of us. You know, you're talking about 50 states and Mariana Islands and whatever else, Puerto Rico to boot. That's a lot of stuff they pulled off. I thought it was terrific. I'll be interested to see what the Republicans do, whether or not they're sharp enough to see that is a great benefit, connecting with people. Of course, there's one thing that Democrats have that's difficult for the Republicans to match, no matter who the candidate is. And that is the Democrats really do represent more of the diversity of the country.
Exactly. I mean,
more exactly. of the people of color, the Native Americans, the black and brown people, but yellow and Hawaiian and Mariana Islands and Puerto Rico. I mean, that is more at home in the Democratic Party. It is a bigger tent party. And that gets shown off when you do this kind of visual. You know, anybody who's smart about American politics today is looking at American demographics, and really smart Republicans who are looking beyond the 2020 election, who are looking beyond the verdict on Donald Trump, are saying our party's in trouble because we're too white a party. This is a journalist talking. This is not a Democrat talking to you now.
Right.
A journalist telling you that smart people inside the Republican Party are worried about where their party is going in the future because it isn't embracing enough.
And let me just say something. So I was watching last night, and you're upset. It was just this amazing quilt of America. And it was just, it was not just the different ethnicities and the different racial makeup and the different, but it was the landscapes behind them, as you point out, you know, I mean, it was like, so again, I mean, a lot of people don't travel America and they've never really seen, you know, what it's like in Hawaii. They don't know what it's like in Alaska. They don't know, but they got to sort of make the connection that this is America. It's so diverse on so many levels, and you got to visually see the people and the landscape. And I think that that's really important. And you did get to see ordinary people, you know, a cop, a mom, a nurse, or whatever. And it brought back something, and I want to scold the media because the media has also been part of our problem. And let me give you an example why. When I ran for governor, I had to file a political action committee because I had to be able to raise money, and I had to file with the Secretary of State in order to raise money. I had to form some kind of a committee so I could actually raise the cash to run for office. You needed two chairmen, okay, to file the committee. And so I had a friend who used to write for the Wall Street Journal, who happened to actually still be liberal. And he called me up and he said, don't have two chairmen, Arnie. Have 1,000 chairmen. I went, 1,000? He said, yes. I said, this is not just a signature. You have to give a lot of information to be the chairman of this committee. He said, you can do it. So I go into the Secretary of State's office and I put this clump of paper. Remember, this is 1991, so it's not by email. You can't do anything online. I plop it on his desk and I said, this is for my committee so I can begin to raise money running for governor. And he said, who are all these names? Why all these pages? I said, it's the chairman of my committee. And he said, Arnie, you only needed two. And I said, I thought I would give you 1,226 more. Now, here's the headline. Now, remember, this has never been done, okay? So I blew everyone away, and all the media is looking at me like this. But here's the headline, which is actually the opposite of why we're celebrating what happened last night. The headline was, Arneson runs for governor. No big names sign on. So as I watched yesterday, and you were talking, and all the CNN and MSNBC and ABC was all cavelling over, look at these regular people, isn't this wonderful? I am laughing because that's not how they used to operate. They used to see how many checks with commas in them were there. They used to see how many big names, how many corporate CEOs. That's how they evaluated your campaign, not on your ideas, not on the 1,228 people that became my chairman. It was the names they could check off. And now in 2020, what is the celebration? It is the diversity. It is the regular.
I got to tell you, the media is still a bit stuck in the mud. When I picked up the New York Times and the Washington Post the next morning, I was driving the car to get coffee with my wife, and I said, what are the first three or four paragraphs of the New York Times? And they made almost nothing of that common element. They did cover it, but I couldn't believe it because it was so striking. Yes, Michelle Obama made an important speech. Yes, Bernie Sanders did what he needed to do, and he gave a good speech. And there were others, John Kasich, former Republican governor of Ohio, and on and on. There were some very good speeches. But what was striking about that event, particularly given the anticipation that this is going to be a letdown because it's not going to be
anything to do. And the challenge, you're absolutely right.
It was exactly the opposite. It was an uplift. It was engaging. I mean, I fully expected, and I went to conventions many times, and I left my spot in the press booth, maybe to go down on the floor, but I left because it was boring what was going on. I didn't leave the couch watching that first night and much of the second night. Right. I stuck to it much better than I did in the old days. Now, in the old days, it went on for 4 or 5 hours, and last night was only 2 hours. So you can say, but that wasn't it. It was gripping. And the music was beautifully woven in. It was a production, and it was a well-done production, and it was a production with meaning. It wasn't just Hollywood glitz or trying to overpower you. It wasn't the halftime at the Super Bowl, with somebody dancing in a very sexy dress and trying to show you a little bit more than you should and keep all the male there panting, at the television sets. But it was America.
We know that Joe is about empathy and that Joe is about loss and Joe is a regular guy. We've heard that over and over again. The vignette before Jill Biden spoke, that sort of story and the pictures and the history of the two of them, reinforced regular in a way I can't even imagine. I thought She did a remarkable job. Michelle did what I think Michelle is so capable of doing, and she's an unusual woman. Jill is not an unusual woman. Jill is a teacher. You know what I mean? Jill is a mom. Jill is someone who comes in and says, God, at age 26, do I want to be a mother with two kids? I mean, you could sort of see all the things that she had to sort of imagine.
Right.
And what you saw was family and love and challenge and grief and this sort of roller coaster of life that she and Joe were able to sort of manage. I went to Paul Tsongas's funeral when Paul Tsongas died, and Paul Tsongas ran for president, okay, remember? Yep. And I went to his funeral, and I always liked Paul Tsongas, but I fell in love with Paul Tsongas at his funeral. Do you know why? Because Nikki Tsongas had, you know, all these people were there from all over the country, all these dignitaries, and there was a huge grand piano in the church. It was a Greek Orthodox church or whatever. And at the very end of the funeral, after all the kids talked, and you began to realize what a marvelous father and family man he was, she then turns to the pianist and she nods her head. And what does he play? I'm going to start to cry. I just called to say I love you. There wasn't a dry eye in the place. That level of intimacy, that level of love. We have to put our politicians as human beings too. And I think that's what Jill did for Joe. You can package Joe, but Jill told us Joe. And I think in a lot of ways, because Donald Trump is all about Donald Trump, which wife is he going to cover? Which family is he going to cover? Which property is he going to talk about? Which golf course is he going to talk about? I mean, you look at his life that nobody can relate to. And then you saw last night, that is in a way what we're yearning for. We know we have to make lots of changes in healthcare and how we vote, in what's going on in the Supreme Court, in the environment. But at the same time, you know that you need to be able to trust someone in order to give them the ability to make those changes. And what I think they're doing, I think, is creating that level of trust.
You just uttered the gold standard word of politics, which is trust. I mean, look at, we're watching it now in Belarus.
Yes.
Lukashenko is losing the trust of his people. He's got an iron hand. I think that's really the fundamental problem for Donald Trump. He didn't have the trust of a lot of people when he started out, but he lost the trust of a whole bunch of people. It's very striking to see the number of people they had, the kind of people they had, saying, I voted for Trump in 2016, and I'm not doing it again. And it's about trust. And trust has to do with vulnerability. People trust somebody who has been vulnerable in the way they have in their lives.
Yeah.
Somebody has faced that kind of trouble, as Biden has faced a number of things. But as you said, you listen to Jill, and Joe himself has got to do it. There are a lot rides on what he says and how he says it.
I know.
In his final night, it's not an open and shut case. And
okay.
No question, the case has been made in terms of the polls. It's been made against Trump for 51-52% of the people. But you don't see the same numbers saying I'm voting for Biden, not just against Trump. So Biden
has
to be revealing about both who he is, where he wants to go, what he's going to do. He's got to connect in a way, and it's a very important moment. People say, well, it's just a speech. No, it's not. American politics changed back in the 70s. We took the power away from the guys in the back room and we gave it to the folks out on the other side of the television screen. So the television screen has become the main way in which politicians gather and hold support.
I want to remind everyone, it's a two-step process. You're going to pink slip the guy that's sitting there, but then you have to hire the next person to replace the person you pink slipped. It's a two process. And you're absolutely right. You know, a lot of people are really concerned about whether Donald Trump has the capacity to be president, and they think he absolutely doesn't. He has the capacity to be an authoritarian, but not necessarily a president. Now the question is, Biden has to make the sell. Before I let you go, because we only have a few minutes left, I have to get you back just to talk about the other topics. Let's talk about the undercount. We've been hearing a lot about the United States Postal Service. We're knowing that there's a lot of turmoil going on there. Your concern isn't about whether we can trust the vote. Your concern is about the undercount. And that obviously also relates to the Postal Service.
There's no question. The reason for the concern about the undercount is it's not theoretical. If you look in New York, they had New York City had 80,000 votes that weren't counted in the city of New York initially because the ballots came in late, because they weren't signed properly, because they weren't made out properly, or because they got lost, or catch this, they didn't have a postmark. Well, they didn't have a postmark because the election board sent out the ballots with a barcoded envelope in order to be able to identify and verify and make sure that this was an honest vote from the right voter. And when those ballots came back in with the barcode, the post office said, oh, we recognize those. We don't have to stamp those. So they didn't stamp them. They didn't postmark them. And when they sent them on to the election board said, we can't legally count those because they've got to have a postmark that shows they were mailed on or before election day. This is nobody's fault, but nobody thought about it. Then you go to Pennsylvania, 26,000, and Nevada, 7,000, and Florida, 18,000, and Michigan, and Wisconsin, and all over the country, there's been this undercount because of these mail problems. This is even before the guy in charge for Trump started shutting down the machines and saying no more overtime. So this is part of this process that's been cut loose by Corona, this enormous, I mean, if you look at the mail vote, it's enormous.
And I have to let you go, but you know what surprises me? That we haven't done tabletop sort of exercises, looking at all the challenges. Do we really want someone who doesn't know anything about signatures to be able to compare a signature and say, yes, this is a valid signature, but they don't have the level of expertise. They're just sort of eyeballing something like they could recognize it. Do we still want people to sort of say, you need to have a postmark on it when, as you just point out, the Postal Service doesn't do a postmark when it has a barcode? It's almost like somebody should have just had this think tank that sort of played it all out and then shared it with all 50 states.
Well, actually, there was. It was. The Brennan Center at New York University Law School did exactly what you said. It sent out a whole bunch of notices, but the politicians and the people in power didn't pay any attention because that was all inconvenient. And they were underfunded. They have not been funded adequately to hire the people to get the expertise. The federal government the Congress has not even voted enough money for a lot of places around this country to protect themselves from Russian hacking.
All right, I need to let you go. Hedrick Smith, you're coming back. We're just talking about this. Maybe we'll touch on the Republican convention too. But anyway, Hedrick Smith is a Pulitzer Prize winning former New York Times reporter, an Emmy Award winning documentary producer for PBS and PBS Frontline. He is a prolific writer. And now he runs an organization, ReclaimTheAmericanDream.org.
Come see my website. See what my story is about, what the Democratic Convention was. It's about what people in Florida, in North Dakota, in Arkansas, in Alabama, in Alaska, what people are doing to fix our political system. It's amazing. It's a wonderful story. And the mainstream media is not telling it.
And we'll get him back, I promise. Hedrick Smith, thank you so much for joining us. And thank you for your eloquence about the convention, because it really did touch on what we saw. So thank you so much. And stay healthy. All right? Just stay healthy.
You too. It's wonderful to see you again, Arnie. Be well.
All right. Ciao. Bye-bye. This is the Thursday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. We'll be right back.
The Great Lakes and the Common Loon on this current cast. With their distinctive red eyes, black and white coloring, and eerie call, the uncommon loon might be a better moniker for these unusual birds. Their solid bones help make them champion divers, and they have an uncanny ability to change direction underwater in a flash. Loons are also a barometer for water and habitat quality, since they're sensitive to pollution and very particular about where to nest. During the mid-20th century, shoreline development and poor water quality in the Great Lakes region forced loons to move their breeding grounds farther north. So if you hear a common loon's haunting call today, let it remind you of the importance of good, clean water. CurrentCast is produced in partnership with Cornell's Atkinson Center for a Sustainable Future. Learn more online at currentcast.org.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1997. That was the day that a strike by the Teamsters Union against UPS ended with a victory for the union. The strike had started 15 days earlier. More than 180,000 UPS workers participated in the action. It was the first nationwide strike by UPS workers. At the time, UPS delivered 80% of all packages in the United States. The company, known for its signature brown trucks, delivered 12 million packages a day. The key issue of the strike was that the company increasingly relied on part-time workers. The insecurities of part-time work were growing, not just at UPS, but for workers in industries all across the country. The strike settlement came with the union winning its core issues. the company agreed to convert 10,000 part-time jobs to full-time positions over the course of the next 5 years. The victory was significant for the U.S. labor movement. The 1980s and 1990s saw new attacks on labor unions and working people, starting with President Ronald Reagan's breaking of the air traffic controller union strike in 1981. The UPS victory in a national strike with broad rank-and-file support encouraged working people beyond the Teamsters Union. Announcing the settlement of the strike, ABC News anchor Peter Jennings declared, quote, "It's been the most dramatic confrontation between industry and organized labor in 2 decades. Teamsters President Ron Carey said, quote, "It's what this country needs. Decent jobs, a chance for the dream, a chance to purchase a home, a chance to bring your children up properly, a chance to send them to college. Enough is enough. And it's about time that people start fighting back on this." Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
There are loved ones up in glory whose dear voices you often miss when you close your earthly story. Will you join them in their bliss? Will the circle be unbroken by and by, Lord, by and by, in a better home awaiting in the sky, Lord, in the sky, in the joyous days of childhood.
Yeah.
Welcome back to part two of the Thursday edition of The Attitude with producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. Again, a reminder, everyone, that we Zoom the day before, so our Thursday show is Zoomed on Wednesday. I've done a lot of work in the New Hampshire legislature. I did a lot of work, actually, when I ran for governor, talking about issues of prison reform, in part because my first committee assignment was state institutions and housing. And the state institutions that I was responsible for included the prisons. I learned very early on something that I would not have normally become acquainted with, and I understood some of the challenges. And of course, now that we're seeing the whole thing about defund the police, and we know about how we incarcerate more people than any other country in the world, and all these stories, you realize that we have to sort of look at our whole criminal justice system. We have to sort of grab it and look at it not as a piecemeal thing, but as sort of one balloon that needs probably to be popped. Before I introduce my two guests who have written a really interesting book that I think I want to send to everyone who's looking on criminal justice reform and looking on prison reform, the title of their book, Prison by Any Other Name, The Harmful Consequences of Popular Reforms. Before I introduce my guests, I just want to share a little vignette with them. I've shared this before on my radio show because you are not the first time we've talked about these issues. It was about 1988, maybe 1989, and we're sitting at a table, and I think it was the majority leader in the Illinois House, or I can't remember exactly what his title was, but he was a very important person. And we were talking about how many people we had warehoused in prison and what was happening to people's ability to sort of actually live the American dream, because at age 17 or age 18, they were being sent to jail. And that meant that whatever was going to happen to them was going to be constrained because of that moment. And he told me an amazing statistic. He said, you know how we plan prison beds in our state? We plan prison beds in our state by going into the second grade class and counting the number of children at risk. Second grade, everyone. They are 7 years old. And everyone at the table was horrified. That was the late 1980s. I suspect that story is still true today. So I just want you to know that as we look at the whole issue of Black Lives Matter, we look at defund the police, we look at the criminal justice system, we really need to begin to have a whole new conversation on what we mean by incarceration. Why do people end up in a situation where they have to be incarcerated? Maybe they don't have to be incarcerated, but how has the system failed them? And that story of second graders, the system failed them. They didn't rob, they didn't rape, they didn't hurt anyone at age 7. They were just struggling to survive. Joining us are the authors of this book, Prison by Any Other Name, The Harmful Consequences of Popular Reforms, Maya Shenhua and Victoria Law. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having us.
Welcome.
Thank you, Ernie.
I'm going to start first by asking a little bit about both of you, because this is a very interesting book. I kind of look at your titles and I'm thinking, okay, what is it about your personal experience that made it almost impossible for you not to write this book? Because I suspect that this isn't just a book that you have studied the criminal justice system, you haven't just reported on it, but this is much more intimate for you. So not only do you bring to the table your scholarship and your knowledge of the issue, but you also bring things that are both personal to you. So I'm going to start with you, Maya. Maya, what is it about Maya's history and Maya's background that meant not only could you study this issue, but you could speak with real knowledge?
Well, so I've been doing work around prison and related subjects for a long time. For me, I think the initial drive to focus on this topic was personal. And it started with my sister being arrested and going to juvenile detention. And then for the subsequent 15 years, cycling in and out of jail and prison, and also some of the so-called alternatives that we talk about in our book, like probation and mandated drug treatment and electronic monitoring. And one of the things for my sister was that most of these incarcerations, or really all of them, if you look at it broadly, stemmed from her addiction to heroin. She would just cycle in and out, and every time it was like she fell deeper into her addiction. The experience of being incarcerated was very traumatizing for her. Trauma is one of the things that drives substance use disorders. So she'd almost immediately start using heroin again when she was out, usually. And this is one of the things that contributed to the work that we did it in this book, or my motivation to be involved in it, is that when she was out here, she would usually, or almost always, be severely confined on the outside. She would have an electronic monitor around her ankle so she couldn't leave her apartment. She would be on probation and subject to really severe restrictions that made it very hard for her to parent her daughter. She would be locked inside an inpatient drug treatment center that was very much like prison. All of these punishments were extensions of prison. They weren't sort of rehabilitative alternatives that offered a different route.
Basically, it was a prison without walls. I mean, there wasn't the physical wall, but there was still a prison. All the things that you're talking about are things about limitation and not about opportunity. It all things that basically sort of don't give you a chance to rehabilitate, but almost reinforce why you ended up going to prison in the first place. So instead of it being a bridge to a future, it basically was a drawbridge that had been pulled up. How do you change your life when what they've done is so confine you and so constrain you that you don't have a life? I mean, you can't fix your life if you don't have a life. And really what I'm hearing from you is that they were basically sort of taking her out of the prison walls, but they were actually denying her ability to sort of have a life. And ultimately, how do you fix yourself?
Right. It was a trap.
It was a trap.
It's like prison.
All right. So Victoria, what was what was your experience that also made you realize that not only did you want to use your journalistic ability, but perhaps you also brought something more intimate to this conversation, which I think is important because it gives you a different set of eyes. Because when you have a life experience, or you have a relative, or you yourself have had an experience, you ask different questions because
yes.
you've lived a different experience.
Yes. Well, I am, I think, older than Maya's sister. So I went to a school. You talked about schools earlier, Arnie. So I went to a school that at the time, now we would call a school-to-prison pipeline school, a school in which people are funneled into the school with the idea that they are being warehoused. They are treated as if they are in a prison. It was mostly Black, Brown, and immigrant. It was people whose families lacked resources to send them to a different school, whether by lying about their address to go to a different school or didn't have money to send them to a private school. There were metal detectors. There were X-ray scanners that you had to go through every morning. It was overcrowded. It was mostly, again, Black, Brown, and immigrant, and it was a perfect recruiting ground for gangs in the 1990s. So one by one and two by two, a lot of my friends joined gangs. They dropped out of high school. They got arrested for gang-related activities, and they were sent to Rikers Island, which is, for listeners who don't know, is an entire island devoted to jail. So yeah. 85% are there pre-trial because mm-hmm. they are awaiting their day in court. I think mm-hmm. at the time there were over 10,000 people detained at Rikers Island on any given time. So that was the first intrusion of the prison system into my life, was going to the school and seeing my friends literally be pushed from this school environment into the jail and prison system. I myself got caught up in some gang-related nonsense, but because of my age, my race, my gender, my size, my lack of criminal history, I was ultimately sentenced to probation. Probation at the time was not as onerous and restrictive as it is now because there was not the technology to enforce it. So I want to be clear that probation didn't fix any of the conditions that had caused me to get swept up into gang nonsense and then into the criminal legal system. It basically was just a, you don't get to go to prison. Today, there are 3.6 million on probation. So that's mm-hmm. more than the 2.2 million people in physical jails and prisons themselves. But it's also a driver for incarceration. Because of the onerous restrictions, you can be sent to jail or to prison for things like not abiding by your curfew, I think I had a curfew of 8 or 9 p.m. at night. I was 16 years old. I did not want to necessarily go home at 8 or 9 at night. Mm-hmm. But there wasn't the technology to track whether or not I showed up at my house at 7:59 or at 8:05 or at 8:30. Today, people are often sent back to prison for things like violating their curfew, missing an appointment with a probation officer that happens in the middle of a weekday. So missing school or work to be able to go and sit for hours in a probation office waiting for your 15
Maybe not having the transportation in order to get there, or someone to watch the child in order to get there. I mean, again, like, they don't take life into consideration. They just say, show up at 2 o'clock. And again, that sounds fine. But when you see all these impediments to getting there at 2 o'clock, then basically they've set you up to fail. So I want to just read a little bit from Publishers Weekly. Sure. And what they said was that you deliver a cogent critique of proposals to end mass incarceration that replicate the surveillance, control, and punishment of the prison industrial complex, rather than offering genuine justice or rehabilitation. A lot of your of what your book talks about, it sort of gives you all these personal experiences of people who the system has set them up to fail. What they thought was reform is not reform. It's actually deform. It's not reform, it's deform. But yet it's because it's not happening within the structure of the prison. It doesn't take place on Rikers Island, Victoria. It must be better. And yet, as you begin to describe, it ain't better. But let me ask a question here, because what I see as setting them up to fail in these sort of prison without walls situations, where they don't have the transportation, they're under lock and key, they can't get to the probation, they're forced to take, you know, some kind of rehabilitation for drugs or whatever, that all these things that are so confining, okay, confining to life. Part of the problem is that it's not just what they've done in the reform, it's that what we fail to do in the investments that we make in all of us. If we don't have a healthcare system, they're really screwed. If we don't have a really good public education system, they're really screwed. So in a lot of ways, what they represent is a failure of how we have failed from a policy perspective for all of us. We may not end up in jail, but we don't end up really succeeding. But if you've had the consequence of having made this mistake that would, you know, warrant you going to court and warrant you going in within the criminal justice system, you end up like failing on steroids. Everything about that mistake now is made worse instead of a form of rehabilitation, Maya. And that's where, as I look at what you talk about all this prison reform, how do we even get to reform if we don't fix the underlying structures in this country that set them up to fail initially? But the system, the way it's rigged, and it's rigged, allows people, especially people of color, people who are poor, people who come from families that don't have a lot of opportunity, it makes it very, very easy for them to stumble into this criminal justice system, Maya.
Yeah, you know, so when we talk about what actual solutions would look like, we talk many of the things that you were mentioning. The idea of reform, the types of popular reforms that we're describing in our book, like electronic monitoring, probation, rescue programs for sex workers, I put that in quotes, and so many of these other other things that are mandating people into these systems, mandating people to psychiatric hospitals, all of these are just replacing the punishment. So they're not changing criminalization. They're not changing, any of those root causes. They're not changing the courts. They're not addressing the underlying structures of white supremacy, anti-blackness, capitalism, economic injustice. All of those things, they're not addressing them. They're replacing the punishment that's tacked on at the very end, and actually a punishment, prescribing a punishment that's very similar to what's already prescribed. One of the things we discussed toward the end of our book is, these reforms are just replacements. They're not actually serving anyone, and they're actually expanding the number of people who are caught in this criminal legal system. Because of that, we talk about those things like healthcare, like voluntary, non-coercive mental health care should be available to everyone, like environmental justice, all of these things that actually affect people's lives from the beginning that impact whole communities. We talk about well-resourced education, of course, childcare, universal childcare. Like this is something that comes up at every step. These things, like to me, it's not necessarily about we need these things and we also need the reform. It's like if we had these things, then the whole criminalization system would be irrelevant, you know?
Exactly. So, as I'm listening to Maya, what I'm thinking about is that, for example, you come out of jail and you're on probation. But usually when you apply for a job, they ask all the questions about your criminal record. Mm-hmm. And as soon as you check the box, then you don't even get the interview. But let's say you find someone who will hire you. They'll usually hire you at $7.50 an hour, or they'll hire you without health care. So you are set up, you're set up to fail. We know that we need to raise the minimum wage to $15. One of the reasons we need to raise the minimum wage to $15 is because of prison reform. Mm-hmm. If you want to send someone out of prison, they got to be able to survive. And if the only job they get pays them $7.25 an hour, they're not surviving. They're going to cheat because they can't eat. They're going to cheat because they can't find a place to live. They're going to cheat. And as soon as they cheat because of their record of the criminal justice system, they're sent back to be warehoused again. So in an interesting way, the $15, Victoria, isn't just about raising the minimum wage. All of us, it's also recognizing that if you really want reform of the criminal justice system, people need to be able to be employed and survive outside the walls of the prison. And how do you survive outside when you can't be paid enough to actually find a place to live, to find a way to eat, and to be able to go to a doctor when you're sick? And for them, it's even worse than for the rest of us, Victoria.
Yes. And we also have to remember that there's the creep of criminalization into some of these institutions that are supposed to be helpful. I mean, earlier we talked about schools. You know, I talked about my school to prison pipeline, high school. You talked about this, the study about second graders and who is considered at risk. I mean, but we can go even earlier. I mean, we've seen sporadic news reports. And they're sporadic, but they're frequent enough that we should wonder what is going on, where you read a news report where a little girl, a little black girl, throws a tantrum at her preschool. Any listener who has had small children in their lives for any more than an hour know that sometimes small children get tired. They get cranky. They throw tantrums. They want muffins. They want something. You know, no parenting book ever says the way to deal with a tantrum is to pick up the phone and to call 911 and have the police come and put handcuffs on this small child and haul them off to the precinct. But every once in a while, we see a news report that states this, that this is the way that the school deals with little black girls that have tantrums. And here is a startling example for your listeners, is that girls are regularly suspended from preschool. So preschool, for listeners who may not know, are ages 3, 4, and 5. These are very, very small children.
Right.
Black girls make up about 20% of girls enrolled in preschool, and they make up 54% of girls who are suspended. So we see that this creep of criminalization starts.
Suspended from preschool?
Suspended. Why would you suspend
that? I'm just thinking, I mean, I understand, maybe I don't understand, but I understand a little bit of suspension of junior high and high school. I mean, I know what they're like, you know, but a 3 or 4 or 5 year old. And you know why that's shocking to me, Victoria? My second husband has a brilliant son. I mean, he's brilliant. But he was also very hyperactive, incapable of sitting in a class. I mean, he's a genius today. I mean, I'm just telling you right now. If you saw him today, nobody ever suspended him. And whenever they would call, there was a problem with him. He was obviously a little white boy. They would call his father. And what his father would do is they would want to give him Ritalin, or they'd want to call whatever. He would just hug him and say, I love you. That was his answer to his son. Today, his son is a wildly successful young man. And I'm listening to you talk about the fact that they would suspend a 3 or 4 year old. Nick would have been suspended 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. I'm just telling you right now. Isn't it interesting that that option was not even considered? And you have to start asking yourself,
is this a color-coded option?
Yes.
And that's what is so scary about this conversation. But I got to ask this question. Again, we're interviewing the authors of a new book, Prison by Any Other Name, The Harmful Consequences of Popular Reforms. Part of the problem right now is that the Republicans are looking at prison reform as a way to save money. The Democrats are looking at prison reform in part because they kind of believe it. They do want to save money. They do buy in that anything outside of the prison system must be better anyway, so let's just get them out. But I'm going to ask a question now because we're living in a very interesting time. We are living in a time of a pandemic. And what we know about being inside that physical institution, Maya, mm-hmm. is that it is wicked dangerous. All right? The problem, however, is you're assuming sending them out is going to be less dangerous. Maybe it's because it's not on your watch. Maybe it's because of whatever. Have you thought about suggestions that we can sort of embrace as we're looking at really removing a significant population from the prison system because of the pandemic, but also ensuring that the removal from that institution doesn't create another sense of urgency and isolation and vulnerability outside the institution? Because again, this is a reform with a gun to our head, and the gun is COVID. That yeah. doesn't mean that the reform shouldn't be thought out carefully as we do it. So have you even thought about what you would recommend as they're looking at this transition, and how do we transition in a time of such vulnerability?
So right now, one of the things that's happening is some people are being released, or at least initially, some people were being released once it became clear that jails and prisons were hotbeds for the virus.
Absolutely.
But many of those people were being released onto electronic monitoring, or they were being put on a list to be released on electronic monitoring, but there weren't enough monitors going around. This is what happened in Chicago and a number of other major cities, was even though there are massive numbers of electronic monitors in circulation, there weren't enough. And so instead of just releasing people, people were being held in jail despite being authorized for release because there weren't enough monitors. Meanwhile, even in the height of the pandemic in certain cities and states, people released on monitors, think about the process of applying a monitor, of monitoring the monitor.
Yeah.
All of that requires people to violate social distancing, just like policing in general violates social distancing.
Yeah.
That whole process is deeply problematic. So I think for us, like, actual release is key. Actual release of massive numbers of people. That's the way to act on this during the pandemic. And of course, what needs to come with that is all those things that we talked about earlier,
right,
actually supporting people.
So Victoria, before I let you go, mm-hmm. I just got to ask, let's say I release them and I'm listening to Maya, and Maya says, you know, don't put on the monitoring, let them go. What is the responsibility of those that are outside the institution that are still technically under the umbrella of the criminal justice system? Is there some role to play where there is any kind of check-in or oversight or connection, or is there anything that is acceptable, or is the idea once they're out, they're out? So I'm just trying to, is there a transition that makes sense to Victoria?
Well, what the question more would be, what would be the point of the check-in? Would the check-in be, hey, are you having trouble finding housing that is safe and accessible and affordable? Is the check-in for, are you able to sign up for health insurance so that you can get your diabetes, asthma, whatever, looked at because you spent years not having this looked at? Do you need help navigating the family court system so you can have your children back? Or do you need help trying to figure out daycare? A study by the conservative Brookings Institution found that the more intense the supervision, the greater the chances of being sent back to jail or prison is. So the point is not supervision as a form of punishment. It is to say, so if the check-in is to check in about people's basic needs, if the point of the check-in is to punish people for any minor infraction, then no.
I love you, Victoria, because I'm with this huge smile on my face. What that check-in is, mm-hmm. is that it's a check-in that wants you to succeed.
Mm-hmm.
You have just said what we really want. We don't want a coercive check-in because mm-hmm. a coercive check-in assumes you're going to fail.
Yes.
We're ready to slap you before we hug you.
Mm-hmm.
All right. And really what you want to do is you want them to succeed. Mm-hmm. Well, then show that.
Mm-hmm.
Then help them with that. Then give them assistance with that. And if the goal is to succeed, then you will be checking in. How's the job? Did you get the healthcare? All those things that they need. Because remember, they're coming out of a place where they're being dropped almost on another planet. Mm-hmm. They may not have the family relationships. It may be 10 years and they don't, mm-hmm. they're in a different world. They need help navigating a system. They don't need to be scolded and told what they can't do. They need to figure out how to do.
Yes.
And what you are saying is that is the most powerful thing in this whole half hour, is that in the end, really what prison reform is about helping them succeed. Again, the title of your book, Prison by Any Other Name, The Harmful Consequences of Popular Reforms, Maya Chenoir and Victoria Law. Thank you so much, not only for taking your experience, but for doing the research and for sharing it with us, because this is a very pivotal time. It's a time where we may actually not only read your book, but take notes and maybe actually embrace that as we look at the reforms that we're going to be, I'm hoping, embracing with this next election, knock on wood. On that note, thank you so much. I really appreciate it. Ciao.
Thank you so much, Arnie.
This is the Thursday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Stephanie Collins and Dave Scott. All right, everyone. We'll schmooze tomorrow. Ciao.